it was an eight month session, so it was very long. How do you think it went?
It was long. It was tedious. There was a lot of very still time, and then a lot of breakneck, 12 things coming at you at the same time. It was a real choppy session. And at the end, it was kind of discouraging because there was just so much that happened in that 12th hour that got no deliberation at all. And that was kind of a heartbreaker to me. I'm kind of a policy wonk and, you know, like to kind of dig into things and talk to people and get other opinions. And, I mean, we had significant policy recommendations get added to conference reports, not something that I was expecting. So I was a little disappointed at the lack of deliberation. And I think it lasted way too long considering what we actually got done. And I think that was our fault in the Senate. We overreached. We filled the budget with a lot of policy that should have been done in separate bills so that we could discuss it at length. And I think they were trying to ram things through. And fortunately, the House pushed back, and we were able to mitigate. They were able to mitigate some of that.
So it was the budget really that kept you guys so long.
The budget, and of course, that's our biggest piece of legislature. It reflects the priorities of the legislature, and that's what took so long.
Mm-hmm. So teacher pay was a big issue, the big sticking point. Teacher assistance. The House, who was coming from the side of trying to preserve teacher assistance, was able to do that. That was one of the things that the House was able to accomplish.
I'm very grateful for that.
Yeah. So there was also this increase in pay from $33,000 to $35,000 for starting teachers, and then the $750 bonus. What did you think of what came out of the budget negotiations?
Well, we know that our teachers are not properly paid. I think they moved up slightly to 42nd out of 50 states. That's not great. We are still losing teachers. In fact, I read recently that we're losing them at an ever-increasing rate. And I don't think that's just pay, but pay would be a big message to teachers that we value them. I think I did in the lull that I described while the House and the Senate were working on the budget and we were waiting for that to get worked out, I spent a fair amount of time visiting schools. And the sense I got was that teachers are wondering why we don't respect what they do anymore. And that, you know, they had gone several years without a raise and then got a pretty paltry raise that not only wasn't big enough, but wasn't fairly administered. And our experienced teachers did not do well at all. And then we didn't make up any ground. And I think, you know, that's my message for this budget. It does nothing to make up the ground that we have lost in education since the recession. Mm-hmm. And I'm not just talking about teacher pay. I'm talking about textbooks and instructional materials and everything that goes in creating a good educational environment for our kids. We're not catching up with where we were in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to do that.
And you had mentioned that the teacher turnover rate, I think it's now at a five-year high at this point, according to that same report you were probably mentioning.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. I mean, teachers are feeling like they're not valued.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the most important element in a classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to change that dynamic.
What did you think of that proposal that died, but I guess could be resurrected in the short session, dealing with charter schools and the way they are funded? It seemed to take some of the money from public schools and put it into charter schools.
Yes, it did. And that the way that was structured would have particularly hurt Asheville, because what it did was it took the tax money that Asheville Asheville City folks pay to augment teacher salaries in Asheville, and it would have distributed that money to charter schools in the county. And I think we have fabulous charter schools, but our primary responsibility is to the public schools, and I know charter schools are public schools, but I remember when the charter school bill was passed, and the idea was that we understood that they were going to do things differently. We were going to give them freedom. We were going to give them the state money, the per diem that we set aside for children. We were going to give them that money and the flexibility to do things differently. And they were going to be able to do it cheaper. Mm-hmm. And I think they're faced now with the reality that it takes money to make for good schools. Well, I think it's wrong for the state of North Carolina to tell Asheville, the taxpayers of Asheville, how to spend their tax dollars. Mm-hmm. And that's what that bill would have done. It also would have transferred money to charter schools for things that charter schools don't necessarily provide. So if a charter school, for example, does not have a meal program, there are federal funds that fund the overhead associated with meal programs, and Asheville and Buncombe County would have had to have redistributed some of that money to charter schools. Well, if they're not providing that service, I don't feel that they're entitled to that money. The real problem, though, is that we're not funding our schools, neither our charter schools nor our traditional public schools, at the levels that we need to and that we used to prior to the recession. Mm-hmm. And we need to make school funding a priority for both, so that they can all thrive like we want them to, like our kids deserve.
Mm-hmm. You were talking about taxes. The budget passed. It changed the way... we are taxing our corporations. Well, corporations, the tax rate was allowed to basically decline some more as it was scheduled to do. Sales taxes were expanded. Income taxes were lowered by some degree, but the expanded sales taxes were expanded to more services. And I know that one of the problems that people have brought up with that is that in this effort to prop up rural counties, that expanded sales taxes is not going to, like, say someone gets their car fixed in Asheville, it's not going to be spent in Asheville. It's going to be then distributed to rural counties.
Well, it's not clear how it's going to be redistributed. And when I say that, there is a table. And if you look at Buncombe County, its value in that table is zero, which means it's not going to get any of that money. And then there are values assigned to each of the counties. And when we asked what the basis was for the numbers in those tables, we didn't get any explanation at all. So I think it's unclear how this is really going to help. I did a quick check at the counties with zero. And there were level one, level two, and level three counties. So clearly it's not about distributing only to the neediest counties, because if that was the case, it would be mm-hmm. only level three counties that were zero. Mm-hmm. So I still don't understand the basis for this sales tax redistribution. And I have not talked to anyone who can explain it to me. And I hope we will get a clearer explanation of what that sales tax redistribution, what the philosophy was, because I think it's all very unclear.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned being frustrated with the last minute provisions. One that didn't make it was the one that would have prevented local governments from doing all sorts of different things. One had to do with affordable housing, living wages, also anti-discrimination measures. And I know that you were speaking out forcefully against that. But could you tell me why?
Well, for one thing, I love some of those measures. I think they're good measures. But for another thing, I think these ought to be the kinds of ordinances that cities and counties can develop. I was a little baffled at why they would even care that we wanted a non-discrimination in housing ordinance. What's wrong with that? More importantly, what I'd like to say to your listeners is thank you, because what we saw happen in just 12 hours, maybe less than 12 hours, is people picked up on that and they mobilized and they got the word out, and we had passed it in the Senate. It was on its way to the House, and in that brief time, there was such, I think, a groundswell of communication to the state legislature that the House decided not to go along with the Senate on this. So I want to thank all your listeners who sent me emails and phoned and called their neighbors and said, do you know what's going on? Because literally, that provision was put into a conference committee report. Mm-hmm. I mean, it did not see the light of day until we were voting on it in the Senate. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really proud to live in a community that is paying such close attention that they picked up on that.
And did you hear from a lot of Asheville people?
I sure did.
Oh, okay.
I sure did. Now, I heard from other people too. The League of Municipalities was mm-hmm. on top of it. Equality NC, mm-hmm. The ACLU. So this was just a bad idea that they tried to slip in under the radar, and I'm proud to say that the people in North Carolina said no.
Yeah, community advocacy works sometimes, even when there's that short window of time, I guess.
I thought it was pretty amazing.
Well, because of Amendment 1, the groups like Equality North Carolina and stuff seemed to have really built up a giant network. And so they were able to seemingly go on social media and really engage people very quickly. And I think because of Amendment 1, they have this infrastructure sort of built up for that already.
Well, they did a great job, and mm-hmm. I'm very grateful.
So one of the big things that did pass was this Medicaid reform. A lot of Democrats were pushing for a Medicaid expansion. Instead, it's been reformed, privatized in some ways. What did you think of that?
I have very serious concerns about the plan. For one thing, it's very complex, and I think another thing is that I think although it provides for both insurance companies to come in and provide that coverage and what we call provider-led organizations, that's when groups of doctors and hospitals get together to provide that care, I think the way it's structured really favors the insurance companies. And there have been a number of states that have tried this approach to containing Medicaid costs. And there is no clear evidence that this saves money, and there is some fairly compelling evidence that it impacts quality care. I did ask the question on the floor of the Senate. I did two things. One is I tried to amend the bill to include Medicaid expansion. I was unsuccessful. And then I asked, what happens to the uninsured? We have a network of safety net providers that provide that care now, but they also provide care to Medicaid recipients, and they will have to compete to be included in the insurance company networks. And my fear is that they won't be able to afford to provide care to the uninsured and still keep their costs low enough to make it into an MCO, the insurance company led entity that will provide Medicaid care in North Carolina, and then what happens to the uninsured? And I did not get any kind of satisfactory answer to that question, and I'm very concerned. And then if those folks end up coming to our hospitals, to our ERs, and drive up the cost there, that's going to threaten healthcare, I think, for everyone in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. So I think this is a major issue that we need to pay close attention to and make sure that we don't destroy the quality systems that we have worked so hard to establish in North Carolina. Mm-hmm.
And I know the federal government will have to approve it, and so it's a couple of years down the road. But does any part of the bill take effect immediately? Does any of that happen before the feds?
I do not believe so. Mm-hmm. I did have some concerns that the Senate version of the bill defunded something called Community Care of North Carolina. And we have a wonderful community care here. It's called CCWNC. Mm-hmm. And what they do is they work to keep healthcare costs down by making sure people on Medicaid have a healthcare home. That means a primary care provider, and that because they have that healthcare home, they know how to take care of themselves. They know how to take their meds. Mm-hmm. They get access to their meds, and so they're healthier. And we did an audit recently that indicated that, yes, this was working. It was working to keep people healthier and to keep healthcare costs down. It was saving the state money. And the Senate version of that bill immediately defunded CCNC. I have significant concerns that we can make this all work without CCNC. And there are some things, they're not quite part of the Medicaid reform bill, but they're more part of the budget. Funding around mental health, for example. There's some shifts in funding around our ADACs. Those are our drug and alcohol abuse centers that I think could threaten their viability long term. And there are also some cuts to payments to our LME MCOs. Those are the folks that provide mental health and behavioral health care to Medicaid patients. And there's just not a lot of slack in those programs. So I'm going to watch those areas very closely as we go forward.
Mm-hmm. And it seemed like the reasoning given for these cuts to mental health was that these providers would be able to dip into their reserves?
Well, and what I would say to that is reserves aren't just money that you sit on. Reserves are money that you are holding because you've allocated that money for other things. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a gross oversimplification of what those funds are intended for. And I know in my office, one of the most common calls I get are families desperately seeking mental health services. And I think we do a great job, but clearly there is a shortage of mental health services in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And this is not going to help.
Mm-hmm. Staying on health care, probably not surprising considering the national firestorm over Planned Parenthood, but they essentially were defunded in the state budget. There was also a last-minute provision related to the sale of fetal tissue. And I know that you spoke out pretty forcefully against those two things. Can you tell me why?
Well, first of all, I think it's important that your listeners understand that we do not even donate fetal tissue in North Carolina. Planned Parenthood does not do that. And in fact, even in California, where they donate fetal tissue. They do not sell it. So what we did is we passed a bill that says something that is illegal is illegal, kind of meaningless. But the whole purpose of that bill was to demonize an organization that's doing great work. And I did a little bit. We had another abortion bill come up earlier in session. And I asked the bill sponsor, Senator Kravick, about the research that they used to justify that bill. And she mentioned a study from the Guttmacher Institute. So I looked up that study. And interestingly, what it found was that if you want to decrease the rate of abortion, the way you do that is you increase availability to birth control. And the programs that we defunded for Planned Parenthood are programs that that prevent teen pregnancy. And there are programs that provide reproductive health to women who can't afford it. Now, those are two wonderful programs at decreasing the prevalence of abortions in this state. And they have been successfully doing that. Mm-hmm. So if you're honestly concerned about making abortions less frequent, what you would really want to do is fund Planned Parenthood. Mm-hmm. That is their primary mission. And you know, what I said on the floor of the Senate was that my mom was 17 when I was born. And it clearly that changed the trajectory of her life. Now, I was able to go to college and provide provide for my children in a way she couldn't. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a woman's right. Mm-hmm. And I will stand up for that.
Mm-hmm. And it's a really emotionally charged issue. I didn't see this, but I heard from other reporters that it was even suggested on the floor of the Senate, I think by Larry Pittman, and I hope I have that right, that Planned Parenthood was distributing contraception that they knew wouldn't work to increase their abortion. So just to give right. our listeners a sense of the debate.
I think that just goes to the heart of this whole issue, that what they have done is they have significantly edited together videotape to create misinformation, and then we are passing legislation based on misinformation. Mm-hmm. And we are knowingly passing legislation based on misinformation. Mm-hmm. I think that's wrong.
Do you know what some of the unintended consequences of that bill might be? I was hearing some stuff about stem cell research, our biomedical, industry, which is booming, of course, in the Triangle area. Are there going to be any restrictions on researchers in say RTP who are working on biomedical things?
You know, I really can't speak to that. Mm-hmm. I do think, though, that this kind of it goes with the rebranding of North Carolina. I think somebody asked me recently why I decided to run for Senate, and I had to say that I remember how we used to be. We used to be kind of a fiscally conservative state, but nevertheless socially very progressive. We believed in education. And we were all very proud of Research Triangle Park and the research that was going on there, and at Duke and at NC State and at the entire UNC system. And what we're seeing is kind of a reaction and a branding of our state around, the opposite of progressive. And I don't think that draws the kind of entrepreneurs that we need to take our state forward and be successful in the future.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of entrepreneurs, as far as trying to draw them in, one of the governor's top priorities was expanding JDIG this session. He got that. It's expanding from $15 to $20 million with the option of $35 million if they're able to land what's called a high yield project, which would be probably a car manufacturer.
Exactly.
Right. What did you think of that? Were you in favor of JDIG grants?
You know, I think grants like that are just the way business is done. I mean, we could argue that states shouldn't compete with each other, but the fact of the matter is they do. And the states that surround us compete fiercely. And we need to step up our game. We lost at least one and probably two car manufacturers that actually would have developed plants in depressed areas of the state. That was a huge loss for us. The fact that it took us 9 months to do JDIG really surprised me. I expected that we would get that done right away. I don't know if you remember, but there was some talk after the short session that the governor was going to bring us back to do JDIG even before the long session started.
Oh, is that right?
And then to have it take until the very end of session is really not how we want to be seen. I know from talking to businessmen that recruiters literally, by recruiters, I mean people who recruit businesses and match them up with grants like that, they took North Carolina off their list.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not good. And we're doing the same thing with, we saw what happened with in Wilmington and Asheville with the loss of our film credits.
Mm-hmm.
And now the solar credits are going away. This is not pro-business. This is not a pro-business agenda.
Mm-hmm. Well, the film credits were somewhat restored.
They were replaced with a grant program.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the problem with a grant program. When you're looking, when you're scouting for a movie, the first thing you have to do is get funding for that movie. That requires a budget,
mm-hmm.
okay? You cannot put a grant, the potential of a grant in a budget. So that might help some small filmmaker get a film made that they couldn't otherwise get made. And that's a good thing. But for a major studio to plan on filming in Asheville, they need the certainty of a credit to want to come here.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have that anymore.
Iron Man 4 was filmed in Wilmington very shortly before the loss of the film credits. And since then, we haven't heard of another major project.
That's right. Meanwhile, Georgia is getting that business.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the timing of just why it was frustrating to see JDIG at the end. And the budget, of course, was at the end as well. And that affected school systems a lot because there was the question of driver's ed. There was the question of teacher assistance. And the budget was not passed until long after the school years began, and so these school districts had to start with that uncertainty. Why is it that, and this is not unprecedented either, this does happen. I think this was the longest session since, I think, 92, but this does happen. The budget, there's usually a continuing resolution, it seems like. Why is it always the budget at the end, and why does it take so long?
Well, the budget is an enormously complex piece of legislation, but it was different this year. And the reason it was different in the short session, now I only have 2 years of active experience with budgets, but
mm-hmm.
the first year what happened was the Senate made their proposal, the House made a counterproposal, and they, in conference committee, they worked out the differences. This year, the House, it was their turn to go first. They made their budget proposal. And I did leave out the governor. I apologize. He actually starts the process. But what the Senate did, which was different and really made a huge change in how this worked out, was they added to the budget a lot of policy, like, for example, Medicaid reform. They put that in the budget. Sales tax redistribution, they put that in the budget. And so there was a lot to work out. That wasn't something where they could say, okay, let's compromise and split the difference. Well, if you have two different philosophies on Medicaid reform, which the House and the Senate did, that's an awful lot to work out. And that's why this budget took so long. It wasn't just that the Senate wanted fewer teacher assistants than the House did. It was a question that the Senate was frustrated that they could not get policies passed in the House that they wanted, and so they put them in the budget and hoped to pressure the House in that way.
What did you think of the negotiated bond package that's going to go before voters in March?
It looks like a good package. It appears that all 100 counties are represented. I voted for that budget, or I'm sorry, for the bond issue, and this is, I think there are a lot of good projects, and there are a lot of overdue projects, so I'm glad that we got that passed.
I was talking to Joe Samquin earlier, and he mentioned the budget negotiations. I know that Tim Moore, and I know this is the House, but they appointed a number of Democrats to what was supposed to be the negotiating committee, I guess. But what came out later was that most of the Democrats basically just sat on the sidelines, were relegated to the sidelines, weren't really a part of the negotiations at all. What sort of input did Democrats have in the Senate budget, if they had any?
There were no Democrats on the conference committee from the Senate side. And pretty much most of the Republicans were on the conference committee, so it wasn't for lack of chairs at the table. And I think it makes for a more divisive process, and it stifles public comment because if they're doing all of this behind closed doors, people don't have an idea what's developing until it's almost a fait accompli. And that really doesn't give you much time to work out the unintended consequences. I think we're going to see stuff come out of this budget that even the Republicans didn't intend. And some of that could have been avoided if they had to say these things out loud. And we at least got an opportunity to react to them, even if they decided not to take our suggestions. I think it's very helpful when we all work together on these things, and I hope to do that in the future.
One thing that seems strange to me is that the House has this rule that the budget has to be made public 72 hours before they vote, but the Senate doesn't.
No.
Why is that? Do you have any
I have
idea?
no idea. I have no idea.
And by the way, 72 hours I don't think would be enough. I couldn't read that budget in 72 hours, I don't believe.
No, but what it does give you, what we do in our caucus is, and we're relatively, there are 16 of us, 16 Democrats, but we all have kind of special interests. Mine, for example, is health and human services and education. And so what we do is we kind of split it up and say, okay, you know more about transportation, you're on that committee, you take a look at that, and then we get together and we kind of share information. So that's how we quickly get up to speed. But literally, we had hours, just a few hours, and that's impossible. So what we've done is, what we do is we look at the highlights, and very quickly, we figured out We're not filling the gap with education that we need to fill, and that the priorities are all wrong. But I'd also like to point out that from the get-go, when you look at most budgets, there are essentially two sides. There's, the money you're bringing in and the money that's going out. Well, the revenue side of the equation was off the table day one. We were never able to ask questions or challenge the assumptions on tax policy. And I think there could have been some really good compromises there had we maybe, since we gave a corporate tax cut last year, put off the corporate tax cut this year and instead fully funded teacher assistants or fully funded textbooks or did the Medicaid expansion. But revenue was off the table. Democrats are not permitted to have any input in that process. And I think it's leading us in the wrong direction tax-wise because we are shifting the burden of taxes from the wealthy and from corporations to working families. And I just don't think that's the formula for success here.
When we were talking about JDIG and the film grants, you briefly mentioned the renewable energy tax credits, which are going to be allowed to expire at the end of this year. What did you think of that?
Well, those tax credits help create a very vibrant solar industry in North Carolina. We are the fourth largest solar economy in this country. And so not only is it an economic driver for us, but I am a believer in climate change. And I think it is foolhardy not to embrace all the technology we can that might have an impact on mitigating the impact of climate change. So, yes, I think we should have extended the solar tax credits.
Do you think the solar industry goes away without the tax credits?
Well, the federal tax credits still exist. So I hope not. But we've seen what's happened with the film industry. So it remains to be seen.
Do you think that, like, speaking of the film industry, now that they've like you mentioned, it's inadequate to what it was before, but they did increase it. Do you think these are recoverable after taking a hit like that? Do you think that the infrastructure can be restored, so to speak?
Well, I don't think there's any interest in restoring that infrastructure. I think they're quite happy with just moving on.
You mean the industry, the film
The
industry?
film industry.
Right.
I just, I have talked to a number of advocates for the film tax credit, and they have convinced me that the fundamental difference between a grant that you may or may not get versus a credit that you can budget for is a huge difference in terms of it takes years sometimes to bring a major project to production. And waiting to see if you're going to get a credit it's like I said, it could help us with some small projects, but it's not going to get us any big projects. And the states that Georgia offers a 30% tax credit. We didn't have to do that because we were North Carolina and we have assets they don't have. But those assets can't make up for a 30% tax credit.
With the solar, with the renewable energy tax credit, what I thought was interesting was that there was this push on the side of that to get rid of or to cap the renewable energy portfolio standard at 6%, and that didn't happen. So what I thought was interesting is that this tax credit going away seems like maybe the biggest loser in that is Duke Energy. I mean, is that because they still are required to boost up their renewable energy production to, I think, 12% or something. I don't remember the years. I think maybe by 2018. And yet they'll have to do it without this tax credit. Now, whether or not they bring up reps in the short session, I'm not really sure. I was very surprised that they didn't bring it up this session.
I was surprised too. I was kind of waiting for that. And I, you know, to be perfectly honest, that I hadn't thought of that, but I'll bet you're right.
Well, I mean, I'm not really sure because I mean, there's all sorts of projects that are, peripheral to Duke Energy. It's just that Duke Energy being the big player in the state energy wise.
Without a doubt.
Staying on the environment, there was that Duke Energy settlement with the state regulators, DEQ, now it's called. I don't know why they changed the name, but it went from DENER to DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality. And that was widely panned by environmental groups as being insufficient to this $25 million fine. It went from 25 to 7, and also sort of granted immunity to all of the other coal ash sites in addition to Sutton, which was the original focus of the fine. What did you think about that?
Well, we have right here in Asheville, we've got that's the CTS site, and we know what it costs a community to have to deal with the aftermath of a situation like that. They've been in litigation for decades, it seems. And so it doesn't make sense to me that we would let them off the hook for that kind of environmental impact.
Switching gears a bit, one of the bills that passed that I don't think Governor McCrory has signed just yet, but he has expressed interest in signing, is this one about sanctuary cities, basically preventing towns and municipalities from instructing their police to not check the immigration status of someone based on I don't know whatever they deem necessary.
Right.
Well, what do you think about that proposal? Do you think that's a good thing, bad thing?
I think it's a bad thing. That's another issue I spoke out on the floor about. This is a public safety issue, all right? And what I fear is that it will prevent victims of crime from reporting crime if they are unsure of their documentation status. That's one of the biggest impacts I see to this legislation. So if you are, I actually asked the question on the floor, if you happen to be a nanny, for example, and you suspect that a four-year-old under your care is being abused by an adult in the house, are you going to feel comfortable to report that to the authorities if you know they're going to have to ask you for your identification? Domestic violence is another example. If you're the victim of domestic violence and you fear being deported over reporting a crime. And the thing is if people don't report crimes, then the whole community is less safe. And so I think this is very, again, it's the sanctuary city. I don't even know what they mean by that, other than sanctuary used to be a good word, but we don't have sanctuary cities here. I don't know what they're talking about, other than to again frighten people on the issue of immigration, and that's just wrong.
I mean, I think what they are saying is that some cities and towns are instructing police not to ask immigration status. Like, say, if someone's pulled over, and I guess the other side would say, well, are they being racially profiled to be asked in their immigration status? Would you ask a white person for their immigration if they, if you pulled them over? And
You know what would have been nice is if we had been able to ask our sheriff or our chief of police exactly what this means and what it means to their ability to do their job. And this was another one of those bills that came up the last day or maybe the second to the last day of the session. I did call. our sheriff, and I called some other people in town, and they had some, I don't mean to speak for the sheriff, but I know talking to some domestic violence attorneys, they had significant concerns about the impact on of legislation like this on community safety, if people don't feel comfortable to report crime.
Mm-hmm. Now, would people not be comfortable to report crime in a city that didn't have some sort of added protection? I mean, is whatever we have in the at the state level, the federal level, not enough?
Well, you know, keep in mind the if you don't have a driver's license, mm-hmm. and you're going to need a driver's license to report a crime, and if you know people who have been deported, it doesn't make any difference. You know, yes, there are avenues that a victim of a crime can use if they have access to an attorney, if they know that that's an avenue available to them, but you create an environment of fear. And I think that's the whole intention of this law, is to create that fear, to create an environment where these people feel unwelcome. And that's not an environment that's conducive to a safe community. I think this is, again, this is one of those, it's a litmus test. It's really not about how our law enforcement does their job. It's an up or down vote. Will you or will you not stand against immigrants? And I think the same was true with the Planned Parenthood vote. Will you or will you not stand against Planned Parenthood? It had really the fetal tissue is the excuse.
Mm-hmm.
And I just really have a visceral negative reaction to those
mm-hmm.
Litmus test votes. For me, it's about good public policy. How do we make our community safer?
Mm-hmm.
And this was not a bill that would make our community safer.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you, and I ask this of Democrats because, you know, being in the minority party, it seems like a lot of just speaking out against, you know, playing defense, a lot of that. During the session in 8 months, were you able to do any collaborating? I mean, do you feel like you're able to put ideas forward and have them get an audience? I mean, is leadership receptive to ideas?
On things that do not brand them. So, for example, I am never going to get a Medicaid expansion bill. I've introduced one bill and two amendments,
mm-hmm.
and they were summarily dismissed. That's part of their brand, though. So I'm never going to get that. But we do work together on a number of smaller issues.
Mm.
I'm trying to think. I was successful at amending the abortion bill. And I supported a number of Republican initiatives. So we work together. I remember overwhelmingly, we vote together,
mm-hmm.
Because a lot of what we do just makes sense. But these divisive issues, no, they're not gonna give us a seat at the table, and that's unfortunate because I think there is plenty of middle ground. I think education is a great example where if we worked together and tweak things a little bit, especially around things like textbooks and professional development for teachers, and just making our schools stronger and better for our kids.
Mm-hmm.
We've got some work to do on testing. I hear a lot from parents that they're unhappy with the amount of testing that's going on in school. That shouldn't be a partisan issue. We ought to be able to work on that together, and I'm hoping we'll do more of that in the future. But clearly, what I'm working hard at in the interim is, and this is very partisan, but it getting more Democrats elected, because we're out of balance. And we need to restore that balance so that occasionally they have to look up and say, well, what do you think? And they can ignore our advice. But I think if they heard it, they would develop better legislation.
What is it like being a minority whip?
Well, it's what can I say? It's if you've been a Democrat or known a Democrat, we're not a group that comes to consensus easily. So it's kind of challenging to get everybody working in the same direction. And I have had mixed success. And I think that's reasonable, because we come from very, very different districts. And our primary responsibility is to our district. But I've learned a lot, and I'm continuing to learn a lot. And I'm hoping they'll continue to trust me with that job.
And what's sort of the philosophy behind, I mean, I know what a whip is entrusted to do. When you don't have the numbers to even block much legislation, even get to vetoes, what are some of the issues where you need Democrats to vote in lockstep? I mean,
For example, the budget. The budget, and the reason is because there are some core Democratic principles, and one of them is education. And so it was just, I did lose a couple of votes, and it had to do with that sales tax redistribution, because some of my members are from counties that really needed that extra income. And I totally get that we have some very distressed counties in the state, and we need to help those folks out. But for me to give voters a reason to get out and vote, they have to know that we stand for something. And so my job as the whip is to remind my colleagues what we stand for, and that on those key issues, we need to stand together. And I had some mixed success with that. The budget is tricky, though, because there are things you like, and there are things you hate, and there are things in between. And so it's difficult, but that's the job of the whip.
Does that mean just a lot of one-on-ones with lawmakers? Is that sort of how you strategically go about it?
A little bit of that. I'll meet with those individuals that I think might be thinking differently. And then we get together before session and kind of hash it out as a group as well. And there are a lot of times when we'll decide, you know, this isn't an issue that we need to define as a Democratic issue. We can disagree on these things. And we never require anyone take a particular vote. Our members are always free to vote their conscience. But it's my job, if I think that this is a defining Democratic value, to convince my members that that is the case.
You mentioned some of the things like Medicaid expansion, things that you just are very unlikely to be able to accomplish considering the numbers in the legislature. But going into the short session in April, are there any things that you think that could resonate and that you hope to see push through, and that I forget how long the session is?
Well, the short session, the primary focus, even more so than the long session, is the budget. And given that it's an election year, I am hoping that what we'll be able to see is better funding for education. And it's been a long time since our state employees have gotten a raise. I'd love to see us make some progress towards that too. But education, again, because, you know, I've said it before and I'll say it again, we need to get back to pre-recession levels The states that surround us are all doing a better job at that, and our kids deserve better.